bandage for him, and now saw in the collapse of his posture the forecast of defeat. What would he be without the commission he had embraced for the sake of the Jews of France, without the urgent work for which his entire life had prepared him? She entered the room. He ignored her as she went to the low table that held the manuscript. She leaned to it and flipped the pages, leafing through to the markers that flagged criticisms. She quickly took several in, the matter of Halevi, of Paul's letter to the Romans, a challenge to a particular word usage. She understood what had just happened, not a true finding based on the merits of their work, but the dismissal by Catholics of a presumptuous Jew. She saw, nevertheless, how the professor's criticisms could be useful. "Papa, we can use these queries," she said quietly. "We can take up these questions one by one and answer them in the book itself. The professors have helped us to make a stronger case. We can do it, Papa." She turned to him. He was staring at her, but his eyes were unfocused. Yes, his blood sugar level was askew. She went to the kitchen for a small wedge of chocolate and brought it to him. As he slowly chewed, she let her hand rest on his head. "We can do it, Papa," she repeated. In the weeks since, her father had never put into words what Laurent's rejection meant to him. Because Rachel made Abelard a Israel seem as important as ever, and still possible, he continued his work as she did hers. They began to take up the flagged queries, one by one. Yet it seemed fated that the grievous fatigue that warned of a worsening diabetes had begun to overcome him. Though he was restless at night, he would sleep in his chair through the afternoon. In the mornings, he still sat with his papers and dictating machine. But Rachel knew that despite her encouragement, he was only going through the motions of work that would never achieve its purpose. He maintained the regimen of his insulin injections, mostly because she supervised it. The ghost of Jean-Marie Laurent haunted their rooms. But Laurent's betrayal, Rachel slowly came to recognize, was a shadow of her own. Only now, sitting at the window of Du Gasson, wearing a yellow star on her breast with a suitcase at her feet, did she fully grasp what had happened, what she had done. The year before, alarmed to see her stalwart father faltering, she had rushed to shore him up, thinking she was doing so for his sake. But since she could not bear the thought of his decline, much less defeat, she had acted for herself, not him. She had so come to prize their collaboration that she could not imagine its being finished. In truth, there had never been a chance that his intimidated Catholic colleagues would welcome a Jew's rereading of Catholic dogma. In the back of her mind, she had always known this. For more than a year, she had lied by encouraging his project. Not only that, protecting the image of his monumental authority, which formed the very structure of meaning she regarded as her birthright, and then protecting the partnership for which she had come to live. Rachel had delivered her father into the jaws of the ancient enemy, which, on a signal from the bald inquisitor, had just snapped down. Chapter 3. In the Manhattan phone book counting Jonathan's and Jay's, there were more than 20 possible John Molloys. The ridiculousness of Michael Kavanaugh's situation struck him at once. What? He should call each fellow out of the blue and ask if he'd ever been a Catholic seminarian? Kavanaugh studied the listings, looking for clues. Molloy, John B., 405 West 45, Plaza 76127. Molloy, John Leonard, 656 10th Avenue, Judson 6, 1590. Malloy, John, Flags and Uniforms, 209 Grand, Canal 66762. Presenting himself at the communion rail that morning, Malloy had been strikingly tailored, so perhaps an enclave of the well-heeled, the Upper East Side or Gramercy Park. Malloy, John P., 26 Montgomery, Gramercy, 34169. But Kavanaugh's eyes kept losing focus as he tracked down the page. Impossible, impossible, ridiculous. He felt foolish. He had always imagined that Runner Malloy would have moved promptly back to Poughkeepsie. Perhaps he did. In that case, passing through Manhattan this week, a simple spur of the moment had brought him to Good Shepherd. John J. Malloy, sales rep for IBM, say, or Mid-Hudson Electric Power, come to the big city to drum up business and, by the way, drop in on an old pal. Or maybe he'd just chosen a church at random, wanting to receive communion, in which case the sight of his old friend, the priest, had flummoxed him. No, no, not at an out-of-the-way parish on the far tip of the island. Malloy had known. Malloy had come for him. But how would he have found him? A phone call to the chancery? No. The archdiocese fronted for its priests. If Runner, on the telephone, had asked for the present pastoral assignment of Father Michael Kavanaugh, he would have been politely invited to send a letter, care of the vicar for clergy. Malloy would have had to go to extraordinary lengths to track down his one-time chum. So his showing up was not spur of the moment. What then? Kavanaugh shook himself for making a mountain of a molehill. Malloy had shown up, that's all. Yes, once he had knelt at the communion rail, his declining to receive was a curveball, but why take it as a message? Maybe it was prompted by a last-minute state-of-grace scruple having nothing to do with his old friend, but why disappear then? What the hell? The tiny letters and numbers of the phone book blurred as an image intruded on Kavanaugh's mind. The last glimpse he'd had of Malloy all those years ago. "I'm gone," his friend had said, standing in the threshold of Kavanaugh's room, an expression of rank misery on his face. He was dressed in his black suit and tie, street clothes. "I couldn't leave without saying goodbye." Kavanaugh, by contrast, was in his pajamas, his bare feet cold upon the terrazzo floor. The knocking on the door that had awakened him had been soft, but Kavanaugh had bolted upright. It was forbidden for students to come to one another's doorways before Lauds, nor were thresholds ever to be crossed. But if what Malloy had just said was true, the rule infraction was meaningless, at least for him. Half asleep, Kavanaugh registered his friend's declaration as a joke. Gone? What the hell? Gone where? Mundus caro et diabolus, Runner forced a grin. Cut the crap, Malloy. No, really. The world, the flesh, and the devil. What are you talking about? I told you, the world, the flesh, and the devil. Here I come. Tears flashed in Malloy's eyes. Ask Agent, he said. He'll explain. With that, Runner Malloy slugged Kavanaugh's shoulder once, sharply. Then he turned and walked away down the long corridor. Watching him go, Kavanaugh noticed how rigidly his friend held himself, arms stiff and hardly swinging, the ramrod posture of a man exerting control over an anarchy of feeling. But all at once Malloy broke into a run, a slowed-down corridor version of that trademark sprint that had given him his name. Smooth, fluid motion. A man suddenly at ease with himself, leaning forward, elbows angled, foot strikes perfectly in sync with the swing of his arms, but falling so lightly as to be unheard. Kavanaugh recalled Malloy's having told him once that, as a child, he had only ever felt free when he was running. First it had been flight from his father's blows, then it had been solitary play along the grassy banks of the Hudson going with the wind like a gull. Then, in school, winning races had been the one thing he could do to garner praise. At the far-off end of the hallway, he disappeared without looking back. Runner, Kavanaugh thought now, in the phone booth. And the simple meaning of the name hit him. Malloy had moved out and moved on all those years ago, while Kavanaugh himself had stayed. Stay of proceeding, stay of adjudication, stay of execution, stasis, stayer, Kavanaugh. He closed the phone book, slapping its heavy cardboard cover and swung it back into its slot below the wall-mounted telephone. Next to the phone, a piece of taped-up paper struck him, a set of the rectory's frequently called numbers, each with its identifying word. Convent, parish school, tribunal, chancery, residence. This last referred to the cardinal's mansion on Madison Avenue, more commonly known as the Powerhouse. Kavanaugh stared at the numbers for a moment, like an uncomprehending pupil at a math problem. The numbers added up to something, but what? The booth stank of cheap cigars and the peculiar odor of the unlaundered cassock, part incense, part B.O. The hell with the numbers, he all but said. As always, it was a relief to push the hinge door open and, with the booth light snapping off behind him, to step into the shadows of the rectory corridor. The hum of the television set came from the adjacent room, the common room, to which the fathers repaired of an evening, after the bingo, the sodality meetings, the last round at the hospital, or, as in Kavanaugh's case, the CYO basketball scrimmage in the school gym. Glancing in, Kavanaugh saw Frank Russell and Billy Mitchell, posted like the library lions, each with his clerical collar loosened and each holding a highball glass in one hand, a cigarette in the other. They were fixated on a newsreel television show. On the screen, a familiar figure was pounding a lectern, but Kavanaugh did not take in what he was saying. In the far corner of the room, behind the fully spread Herald Tribune, was another priest. That would be Joe Galen, who disdained television, but begrudgingly forced himself into the corner chair for a nightly display of community spirit. Frank and Billy were a pair of burnt-out but harmless cases, 20 years Kavanaugh senior and 30 years older than Galen, whom they mocked as Suede. Since the wicked nickname derived from Suedo intellectual, the priests had dosed it with self-mockery, too, as if they themselves could not pronounce pseudo. The name had stuck, and Suede Galen, with forced camaraderie, even answered to it now and again. In fact, Galen was a part-time doctoral student in theology at Fordham, and there was nothing pseudo about his brain power. Of the three priests, Kavanaugh preferred the old coots. Their ardent goodwill had long ago cooled into the chill of causing no trouble, checking off boxes on the parish duty list, ducking the sweep of Powerhouse radar. But to Kavanaugh, the thought of actually joining them in front of the TV seemed insufferable. He saw now that the newsreel featured a fulminating Joe McCarthy, whose pudgy face looked flushed, even in black and white. His arm was raised above his head, his fist was clenched. Kavanaugh hated to have to watch or listen to the buffoonish Wisconsin senator, but he needed that drink. He slipped into the dark-paneled, heavily curtained room and moved to the oak table opposite Galen. Half a dozen bottles of booze stood guard over a pewter ice bucket and a spread of glasses. He poured a couple of fingers of bourbon, dropped in some ice, then moved sociably enough to stand behind the two old priests. "Howdy, Mike," Billy said, looking up. As always, a tear ran down his right cheek, where the oddly pale skin was flattened. As a young man, the priest had been a doughboy in France and had taken shell shrapnel to his face, losing an eye. On that reconstructed side of his face, he had no feeling. The tear duct at his glass eye regularly overflowed, making it seem that Billy was weeping. But he wasn't even aware of the tears. It was odd. The children in the school were famously frightened of Father Mitchell. But he was a sweet soul. "Catch Senator McCarthy," he said. "Now listen to this." McCarthy, with his florid ruddiness, sweaty forehead, widow's peak, and shapeless suit, looked like an upended pile of soiled laundry. He was raucously holding forth in front of a wildly appreciative audience, declaiming, "The final Armageddon foretold in the Bible." At that, Frank Russell let out a howl of approval and reached over to slap Billy's shoulder, spilling ashes on his black shirt, a mess of which Billy took no notice. "That struggle between good and evil, between life and death." Billy and Frank jostled each other. The triumph of hearing the Bible appealed to, their own vocation given sudden relevance. "You tell him, Joe," Billy cried. "We cannot survive on half loyalties," McCarthy went on, "any more than we can fight the facts of communist conspiracy with half-truths." Kavanaugh's glance went to the corner where Joe Galen, having lowered his newspaper, was waiting to make eye contact with him. They smiled at each other, united suddenly in a feeling of sad embarrassment. Kavanaugh crossed the room and took a chair by Galen's. "Captain O'Blunder," Kavanaugh said, raising his glass. "Patrick O'Trigger." Galen brought his glass up, and they clinked. Galen added unnecessarily, "McCarthy's a disgrace." "Tail Gunner Joe," Kavanaugh said, television's idea of a mick. "The Jews," Galen replied, "love to see an alcoholic Irish Catholic making an ass of himself." The remark surprised Kavanaugh, the swerve of it. He sipped his drink. Galen started to lift his newspaper again, but Kavanaugh said, "Why do you say that?" "Because he is. McCarthy's a drunk." "No, I mean about the Jews." "John Cameron Swayze?" Galen gestured toward the TV with his glass. "The newsman?" Kavanaugh asked. "Swayze, Michael, Swayze. They're all Jews. Television, movies, show business. Walter Lippmann, obviously. Walter Winchell. But all the others, too, they changed their names. Milton Berle, Bob Hope, George Burns, Gracie Allen. Jews." "Bing Crosby?" Kavanaugh said, grinning above the rim of his glass. Galen did not answer. "No, really, Joe. Bing Crosby?" "No," Galen said. "Not Bing Crosby." He lifted the paper again, hiding. "You scared me there, Joe. What with Bing playing Father O'Malley in the Bells of St. Mary's, what would Ingrid Bergman say if her lovable pastor was Jewish?" From behind the paper came the one word, "Bergman?" Kavanaugh stared at the front page of the Herald Tribune, taking in the headline, "General MacArthur Wants Atom Bomb for Korea." It had never occurred to him that Ingrid Bergman was Jewish. But then he thought of Casablanca, Philip and Julius Epstein, Peter Lorre. What about Humphrey Bogart? He took a drink. Normally, he'd have thought nothing of a fellow priest's crack about Jews. But for some reason, it cut him tonight. Then he knew. Galen had made plain an intention to stay behind his paper. But Kavanaugh said, "Joe, actually, I've got a question for you." In fact, Kavanaugh realized, Galen was the only one in the rectory who would have a clue to what had nagged him all day. "Simone Weil," Kavanaugh said. "What about her?" Galen said. "Was she an anti-Semite?" The Herald Tribune came down, collapsing into the priest's lap. "Don't be ridiculous. She started out Jewish." "But she compared the ancient Hebrews to the Nazis. Said they were alike." "I never heard that," Galen said. "In her journals, the one still in French, not translated into English yet." The younger man was silent for a moment, deliberately quizzical. No priest at Good Shepherd could read works in French, certainly not Kavanaugh. Well, if she made that comparison, he said finally, she had a point. Blessed be he that shall take and dash thy little ones against the rocks. Can't you see the Nazis doing that? Do you know how many times the Old Testament celebrates the murder of children? No, Joe, but I'll bet you do. Read the Psalms, Father. I do read the Psalms, Joe, 5 times a day. And the prophets, Jeremiah, the ancient Hebrews, practiced child sacrifice, infanticide. Bullshit, Joe. The whole point of the Abraham-Isaac story is to end child sacrifice. Exactly. Proves the point. Genesis can't order the end of child sacrifice if the ancients aren't practicing it. And Exodus, Passover. Hitler had nothing on Yahweh's angel of death. Every firstborn male baby of Egypt killed by the will of God, please. Kavanaugh said, Jesus was killed by the will of God, Joe. Not my will, but thine be done. Galen snorted. His blood be upon us and upon our children. In point of fact, Father, that's the Jews, not God. Christ killers. Simone Weil was right. It's not anti-Semitism to speak the truth. The priest snapped his paper up. Kavanaugh was surprised, less by what the smug young bastard had said than by his own reaction to it. Theological impeachment of Jews was run-of-the-mill. Visceral rejection of such judgment, that was new. Blood be upon our children? How many children died in the death camps? For the first time in his life, Kavanaugh heard the phrase from the Gospel of Matthew as an incitement. But Joe McCarthy must have further outraged himself just then, because an unrestrained burst of applause exploded from the television, echoed by the hoots of Frank and Billy. Kavanaugh stood, crossed to the oak table, hit his glass with another splash, and left the common room. In the corridor, by the phone booth, he stopped. Ask agent, Runner Malloy had said all those years ago. And Kavanaugh had. Agent, as he was known behind his back to seminarians, was Father Sean Donovan, the church history professor. Because he was an Irish import, the priest was stamped in the argot as FBI for foreign-born Irish. That, in the razor-sharp remaking of the compulsive nicknamers, led to the moniker Agent. The inevitable edge of ridicule involved in Father Donovan's case, his being badly overweight and having the pasty flesh of one to whom athletic fields or shooting ranges would have been terra incognita, the polar opposite of a G-man. Yet Father Donovan, then a man of about 50, was perhaps the most beloved member of the faculty. Still, Kavanaugh remembered being surprised at Runner's reference, because John Malloy had not been one of Father Donovan's lads. He'd gone for spiritual direction to someone else. Kavanaugh couldn't remember whom. Sean Donovan was still Kavanaugh's good friend, even if, for the last 10 years, he had been, as one of the archdiocese's 2 auxiliary bishops, Cardinal Spellman's left-hand man. The cardinal had a genius for manipulating his clergy, and Bishop Donovan was the designated good cop, nicely balancing resentment stirred by the cardinal's right-hand man, Bishop Alonzo Grant, who was known behind his back as G.I. for Grand Inquisitor. Grant, in fact, was the power in the powerhouse, the enforcer. Compared with him, Bishop Donovan was a sob sister. What stymied Kavanaugh at the phone booth was a mad impulse to give Sean a call, but at this hour? The phone would ring in the residence common room where Grant could be sitting, or even Spellman himself, calling the powerhouse near midnight. Are you nuts? Kavanaugh took his drink along the dark corridor, then up the narrow stairs, bypassing his own third floor, to spiral all the way up to the heavy door that opened onto the roof. The rains of the day had passed, but the air was still murky. In the lee of the mechanical shed, He found his battered beach chair stowed up there since September. The canvas contraption, once he opened it, was the instrument by which he turned the remote tar-paper roof deck into his personal refuge. He had not expected to be up there again until May or June, but the day's strange and sudden anguish compelled him. He sat, shivered, hugged himself against the November night's chill. Kavanaugh had spent the war as a Navy chaplain, assigned mainly to the Navy Yard Hospital in Brooklyn, where there was a tar-paper rooftop cubby like this, to which he'd escaped at night. Thousands of the wounded and dying were evacuated from the war zones to that hospital, and his job had been to hold hands with the weeping and the catatonic alike, anoint their foreheads, close their eyelids, then write letters to their parents. Across the nearly 3 years he was there, the space between hospital beds went from 8 feet to 6, then 3. By the end, even the amputees counted themselves lucky. And by then, Kavanaugh's nighttime escape to the rooftop had become habitual. From there, he looked out across at the Manhattan skyline, as if from the bridge of a ghost ship. But tonight, from his ghost rectory, he took in the far less glamorous, if equally familiar, silhouettes of the water towers, stairwell sheds, and stepped-back roof lines looming over Inwood. Here and there, lights were being snapped off. At last, Kavanaugh took the truly hefty swallow of whiskey he'd been waiting for all evening. Back in the day, at the seminary, Father Sean Donovan's history classes had been marked by levity. Even lecturing in Latin about the quaestiones of Thomas Aquinas, he'd toss off wiseacre asides, carpe noctem, in warning about an upcoming exam that thrilled the lads, just because they got the joke, spend the night studying. Like all priest faculty, he doubled as a spiritual director, and more young men lined up at his door for counseling than at any other professor's. He was Kavanaugh's confessor, an intensely trusted mentor, from whom Kavanaugh kept no secrets. That day of Runner's departure, immediately after breakfast, in the work period during which Kavanaugh was supposedly mopping out the shower stalls, he went instead to Father Donovan's room on the priest's corridor, aware of a tangled knot in his breast, feelings for which he had no name. He hesitated at the door, fingering the top buttons of his cassock. Finally he knocked. "Come," the priest said, his voice muffled by the stout door. Kavanaugh entered. "Good morning, Father. I'm sorry, but never mind that, Michael. I expected you." Then Father Donovan added, as always, the Irish pleasantry, "You're very welcome indeed." At the priest's lilting brogue, Kavanaugh's spirits lifted. Father Donovan was seated at his desk, his breviary open before him. Like Kavanaugh, he wore the floor-length soutane, although the hefty priest's collar was unfastened, as usual. He stood and offered his hand. The grip was strong, conveying an unexpected depth of feeling, which Kavanaugh knew to take as a declaration. In the corner opposite the neatly made narrow bed stood a pair of cracked leather wing chairs. The men sat, each one knowing which chair was his. "You've come about John." "He's gone?" Kavanaugh asked. The priest lit a cigarette and used the waving out of his match to dispel the first cloud of smoke. "He is, Michael. He resigned yesterday." "Resigned? I assumed kicked out for some reason. If Runner was going to quit on his own, he would have told me." "I gather he did tell you." "But only this morning, on his way out the door. He left while it was still dark." "He didn't want to fuss. And you know how the rector deplores display when a lad is moving on." There was consoling sadness in Father Donovan's eyes. Kavanaugh said, "But it seems like something shameful is happening. The priest said nothing to this. Is there? Again silence. Kavanaugh shuddered to think he was intruding on the seal of confession. Father, he said at last, Runner told me you would explain. Yes, the priest nodded solemnly. He gave me permission to explain to you, only to you, and he expects you to keep the confidence. What confidence? Kavanaugh could hardly breathe. The priest took a long, deep drag, not lowering his gaze. He let the smoke out and tapped the ashtray on the table that stood between them. Kavanaugh sensed the pulsing behind his own eyes. He looked down at the rug, a threadbare oriental, along the edge of which the priest's shoe tapped nervously at a comb of fringe. Will you? The priest asked. What? Keep John's confidence. Of course, but what gives? I don't get it. Why wouldn't he have talked to me? John was struggling with his vocation, Michael, for some time. He loved it here, Father. Ace student, best jock in the class, who didn't like the guy? At some point here, Kavanaugh knew, there would be no holding back his tears. Father Donovan was the only one in whose presence he ever wept. Runner wanted to be a priest more than I do. But you're still here, son. He's not. It was really quite simple. John felt a need of love that he could not satisfy as a priest. Jeez, Father, who doesn't have that feeling? I don't. I know, but you're... It took an awkward, long moment for Kavanaugh to add, already ordained. He made a prudent choice, lad. Prudence may not be the greatest of virtues, but it's the most useful one. Silence fell between them then, excruciating silence, endless silence. At last Father Donovan said, Michael, he told me to tell you something. The priest paused. He puffed his cigarette. He batted at the smoke. He said, John made his decision because of you. What? After much prayer and discernment, he had concluded that his feelings for you were out of bounds. The stark declaration stunned Kavanaugh, flummoxed him. Instead of reacting with the spilt rush of emotion he'd been dreading, he simply clamped down on all feeling. Dive! Dive! The hatch covers of a plunging submarine swirling shut like in a movie, and dive, Michael Kavanaugh did. Ever after. In recalling that moment now, from the ship-like deck of the rectory roof, Kavanaugh recognized what he had snuffed. The unfamiliar feeling from that very morning, what had sent him reeling through the thickets of Inwood Hill and Fort Tryon Park, not guilt, as he'd have predicted if he could have foreseen this recollection, but grief. Even in his mid-twenties, Michael Kavanaugh had been a callow boy far younger than his years. He now looked back on the lad he'd been through the distorting lens of a parish priest's long experience of the confessional, listening to ugly secrets. But he still recognized himself as that tenderfoot. In being green, naive, unaware, young Kavanaugh had not been special but typical of the kind of Catholic kid who welcomed the chance to sublimate the deepest but also most frightening specimens of desire. Beginning with his mother, who'd lullabied him, a chosen child, Kavanaugh was raised to a status apart. Wasn't he blessed with a heightened sensitivity to the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of all that is unseen? Wasn't his a capacity for depth of which his brothers and sisters, through no fault of their own, knew nothing? So went the story told to young Michael. He had the feel not just for God, they said, but for God's grandeur in all that is. He was born to be a priest. Well, he thought now, they don't call it parochial school for nothing. Ignorant of boundaries. So what was out of bounds. He had not known in particular what Father Donovan might have meant by that phrase, and actually he had not known in general either. If in Kavanaugh's own personal bubble at Dunwoody the love of women was remote, the erotic love of men for men was simply unimagined. Such a totality of denial suggests what terrors the homoerotic held for the seminary culture, and that culture had fit Kavanaugh like a glove. His affection for Molloy had been as absolute as it was unselfconscious. Kavanaugh would have said, if the question had ever come up, that his feeling for Runner was absolutely chaste. But all at once, in the priest's room, that bond had somehow been made to seem sinful, filthy. Molloy, by leaving Dunwoody like a thief in the night, had himself declared it sinful, a moral flip of which Kavanaugh had known nothing. Yet that not knowing, he understood now, was its own offense. Such innocence, here was the lesson, is not a virtue. And at a certain point for sure by the time a man is shaving every day, it becomes mere self-deceit. Looking back at that moment, Kavanaugh saw in a flash how his entire youth had been fraudulent. And now? His world, beginning when the nuns joined his mother in the conspiracy of vocation, but continuing right through the seminary equivalents of college and graduate school, with black-robed professors affirming him, was an enclosed terrarium that pretended to be the unfenced frontier. How hedged in were they? If the word seminary shares a root with semen, the linguistic joke was not one the lecturing Father Donovan would have tossed off in class, nor would his precious lads have found it funny. But all of this, oddly, was key to what had made John Molloy attractive in the first place. Without the seminarians being aware of it, one effect of the implicit but potent restraints on feeling that defined experience at Dunwoody, the wages of repression, was to paint the tone and tenor of the place with the gray that makes warships invisible at sea. But Runner Molloy, by personality and force of will, had been color itself, with no one more attuned to his standing apart than Michael Kavanaugh had been. Molloy had carried himself with a light-hearted flair that, in the haunted house on the hill in Yonkers with its dark hallways, musty stairwells, gloomy dining hall and faux Gothic chapel, seemed forbidden. His easy masculinity was marked by small notes of personal style, black leather belt worn with buckle to the side, watch band, a loose-fitting spidel of stainless steel which hung on his wrist like jewelry, slip-on shoes that flapped slightly at his heels when he made the genuflection during Mass. In fact, his genuflecting way of touching his right knee to his left heel displayed an unselfconscious grace that seemed akin to the astounding moves he routinely made on the basketball court. There was, that is, something princely about Runner, a smiling tough guy who, in making a point, could rest his hand effortlessly on Kavanaugh's shoulder, an intimate gesture that, because it couldn't be helped, couldn't be wrong. How could any of this, then or now, be out of bounds? Because of you, Father Donovan's words hovered in Kavanaugh's head. Runner's laugh could roll across a room, clearing whatever clogged the air. When Kavanaugh in literature class had learned about irony, he understood how Molloy's regular bemusement at the many incongruities of seminary life fell short of mockery. Kindness, manliness, intelligence, and beauty had come together so easily in him that it seemed everyone should have been kind, manly, intelligent, and beautiful like that. But no one else was. Because of you. After that day, Sean Donovan, as Father Donovan and then as Bishop Donovan, had never again mentioned John Molloy to Michael Kavanaugh, nor had Kavanaugh to Donovan. Kavanaugh, sitting now on the midnight roof, swirling what remained of his ice cubes, saw how absurd that was and how inhuman. As bishop, Sean Donovan was no longer Michael Kavanaugh's confessor, but he was still as good a friend as he had on planet Earth. And they had never discussed Runner? Kavanaugh saw the rough outline of what he had deflected all these years. That if Runner Molloy had been thrown off course by some inchoate, wrong-seeming feeling of love for him, he, Kavanaugh, had mercilessly stayed that course, which then took him into a life with a hole at its center. He had successfully papered the hole over. But it had been there always, a hollow void where once had pulsed a pure feeling of lift. When Runner so suddenly disappeared because of a dread attached to him, Kavanaugh had found it the most natural thing in the world to shut off instantly the youthful lightness of heart that had attracted Molloy in the first place, the lightness that their friendship had intensified and that had defined for Kavanaugh the meaning of the state of grace. Across the years since, Kavanaugh had unconsciously refrained from thinking of Runner, but on this night, he had to admit to having forgotten nothing. Yes, this was grief, raw, unfinished grief, not just at the long-ago loss of a friend, but at the loss of nothing less, despite appearances, than his own, what to call it, wholeness? Integritas. Kavanaugh sipped. He'd been shivering all this time. He let his eyes drift across the nightscape, acknowledging the wish to be somewhere else, as if the looming tenements could be the walls of canyons, the squared-off silhouetted rooflines, the buttes and flat-top mesas of a John Ford location, shot with blue tint. Indeed, the walls of the buildings opposite could have been prehistoric rock faces, with each lighted window the marker of a cliff dweller's fire, a scene thick with primitive humanity, Fort Apache. But this was not the West. The people whose cramped rooms were across the way, dozens and dozens of them, were the furthest thing from exotic aboriginals. They were post office clerks and grease monkeys and widows and meter readers and bus drivers. They were all clinging to hopes of which they spoke in whispers to no one but their beloved priest, their kind confessor, their Father Mike. Kavanaugh felt a rush of worried affection for his parish, and becoming more kind to himself, acknowledged his satisfaction that, whatever the celibate's clamp on warmth, tenderness, desire, and longing had done to his capacity for true intimacy with another, still, he had somehow emerged from his years of disciplined pastoral service as a priest on whom the people could depend, not to mention God, whoever that was. He was a connoisseur of other people's moral complexity. But what of his own? "Oh, the hell with that," he said out loud. Kavanaugh raised his glass toward the darkened tenements, a toast to the fact that, yes, as he insisted silently, the widows and clerks and telephone operators and all their raucous kids were enough for him. But then Kavanaugh's gaze lifted to the ink-black shape of the distant landscape, a subtle backdrop against which the foreground buildings took form. Inwood Hill, and beyond it, Fort Tryon Park, of which he'd hardly ever taken note from his rooftop airy. He saw jutting above the trees the barest upper edge of what he now could note as the monastic bell tower, the cloisters, which promptly brought the image of the woman to mind. Grief. Runner Molloy, yes, but also her. You should complete your obligation, Father. Her last words to him. But what obligation? Was there an obligation to an unfinished grief? There it was. The feeling that she had sparked in him, and which even now he'd only partially fathomed. Rachel Vedette. Simone Weil. Her refusal to be modern, her empathy with suffering, which was limited but quite real. Kavanaugh's mind went back to Galen and his sanctimonious contempt for Jews. Suddenly, Kavanaugh realized why that routine Catholic denigration had cut him. The Passover angel, like Hitler? Ancient Hebrews, like Nazis? Kavanaugh took offense because he had heard Galen as if he himself were Rachel Vedette, a Jew. So naturally her voice was coming back to him. In French we say cloître, gaunt, stern with herself, but not with others. He thought of the ease with which she'd let her hand rest on the upper ledge of the arcade column, the natural pose that suggested not just authority, but proprietorship. The exotic place was hers. The cloisters were a last vestige of Christendom. But what had Christendom just done in the Europe from which Rockefeller's medieval relics had been so timely plucked, except destroy itself? After the obliterating war, the already set Hilltop Museum in New York, without any reinvention of its own, had become a memorial to an entire culture's suicide. In her identity with the place, the woman, who might otherwise have been a simple witness, had herself become a mode of remembering. Her pallor was the clinging shadow of some other angel of death than God's, but she had refused to die. And that, he suddenly understood, was what had drawn him to her. Chapter 4. The sport of bicycle racing, too, was conscripted into the Hitler-driven campaign against the Israelites of France. The Winter Bicycle Track was a huge indoor racing arena designed to accommodate nearly 30,000 spectators. Now it held the Jews of Paris. They were brought there not in trucks or prisoner wagons, but in the ordinary green and cream-colored municipal buses that most had ridden every day of their lives. One of those Jews, thrown into the Vélodrome d'Hiver within 2 hours of Monsieur Béguin's phone call, was Rachel Vedette, for whom the sudden horror of the ordinary Paris bus, onto which she'd been violently dragged by a former ticket-taker, seemed a defining measure of the day's meaning. The Vale d'Ive stood on the left bank in the 15th arrondissement, not far from the Eiffel Tower. Indeed, the arena had been built for the World's Fair in 1900 when Eiffel's soaring pylon of girders served as a focal point for the festival grounds. Ever since, the massive shell-like rink had been the scene of great spectacles, not just the match sprints and team pursuits of cycle racing, but also boxing matches, ice shows, including several starring the Nazi-friendly Sonja Henie, and throughout the 1930s, great rallies of the French fascist parties. But freewheel, brakeless bicycles whizzing along at 90 kilometers an hour were what brought frenzied Parisians to the place again and again. Speed, and, with inevitable crashes, blood. Who didn't love the Vale d'Ive? A steeply banked oval track made of wood encircled a large infield. Above it all hung two severely raked tiers of seats which loomed like mountain ledges over a valley. The velodrome roof was made of a great patchwork of glass and girders, but the glass had been painted black 2 years before because of air raids, and a cloud of gloom enshrouded the place even before the terrified and disoriented Israelites arrived. The Vale d'Ive was where the French National Police brought their prisoners. But it was the so-called gabardines, the Germans in civilian clothes, who'd instructed them to do so. The arena had been requisitioned by the Gestapo a year ago, but for a purpose coming clear only now. By midnight on July 16th, something like 8,000 people had been herded into the vast open space, then left to their own devices behind locked and guarded doors. They would be joined within a day by half again as many. Gendarmes could be seen amid the throng with their batons and holstered pistols. But no one was pretending to bring order to the anarchic scene. Children wailed in corners by themselves, ignored. Family groups fought one another for cleared places by the wall. Circles of Orthodox men, wearing yarmulkes and wrapped in prayer shawls, davened away, their rhythmic, dipping motion like birds dropping beaks into fountains, was a declaration of detachment from the horror around them. But they were aged, because the Jews of Paris had long assumed that only able-bodied males were vulnerable, and because Jewish men had therefore made themselves scarce. Most of those arrested that day were women, children, and the very old. They clutched bundles, boxes, suitcases, whatever they'd been able to grab before being seized. They appeared to fear their fellow prisoners as much as the mostly unseen police. A great stench filled the place, and it shocked the prisoners to realize that they themselves were its source. Like the others, Rachel held fast to her suitcase. To her, the scene was like a dream of hell, the kind of vision conjured by self-tortured medieval monks, lacking only personified red devils leering from the margins of illuminated vellum. Herded into the arena like animals into a vast slaughterhouse pen, the prisoners now sat in clusters, holding on to one another, or they wandered about singly, stupefied and lost. Pairs of children shuffled aimlessly, clinging to each other's hands. Some had cardboard tags attached to their shirts with names. The arena toilet rooms had been locked because, as the gabardines saw it, their windows made escape seem possible. So heaps of human waste had begun to accumulate in the back row of the lower-level tiered seats that an ad hoc latrine had somehow been defined by the prisoners themselves was the only semblance of order, and most, but not all, headed into that remote shadow to defecate and urinate. Rachel was looking every person she passed in the face, hoping for a flash of recognition, hoping, of course, for her father. She had applied a fierce clamp onto her emotions and channeled all feeling, thought, fear, and bewilderment into the act of focused observation. Finally, she came upon a passing blue-uniformed policeman, and when he looked toward her, she stepped directly into his path. He drew back, startled. He was young, perhaps as young as she, showing no sign, for example, of needing to shave. On his shoulder the patch read, Préfecture de Police de Paris. Therefore, he was not a member of the gendarmerie, the far more powerful national police force, which was, in fact, in charge of the arrest of Jews. Rachel had already accommodated the startling discovery that French officials were doing the savage work of the hated Germans. But the gendarmes wore brown uniforms. This flic was in blue. Was he a local cop who'd stumbled into this madness? And did the disoriented expression that came across his face now suggest that his uncertain will could be bent to her will of iron? The young cop was clearly a man of no rank, yet she addressed him as if he were. Sergeant, s'il vous plaît. Reflexively, he tipped his hat. Rachel was pleased to see a rush of blood to his face. Mademoiselle, he said. I am searching for my father, she said. As if she were a connoisseur of the tricks of flirtation, she let her glance fall shyly, then brought it up again while biting her lower lip. She could feel water pooling in her eyes, the first counterfeit of such affect she'd ever accomplished. She pushed her shoulders back slightly, but enough to bring her bosom forward. Her free hand went first to her hair, where the once severe bun was in disarray, as if drawing attention to the fact that most of the other women wore carefully knotted headscarves. Then her hand went to a button at her throat, which she undid as if from pure nervousness. The loosened collar fell from the hollow of her neck toward the upper curve of her breast, showing a small but potent strip of flesh that had never seen the sun. She began to speak once more, then stopped. She let the tip of her tongue slide across the edge of her lower lip, just visible to the policeman. She knew when his stare settled on her mouth. Thus, in a matter of seconds, she had drawn on previously unknown wiles to put her offer in the air, the promise of exchange. She said, "Will you help me?" But she was thinking once more, "Who am I now?" That first afternoon, the young Flick had escorted Rachel in a spiraling circuit of the sprawling arena infield, breasting through the crowd of stunned Jews, needing only the occasional rough show to clear the way when some crone refused to move. "Déplacez, déplacez," he barked, but his menace was fake. At one point, the cop had grasped Rachel's free hand. She let him hold on to it, but noted that he shyly pretended that clutching her fingers was necessary to leading her through the press. He was anything but domineering. Soon enough, he had become almost as invested in finding her father as she was. Even before dusk outside, the vast interior space beneath the blacked-out glass roof had become awash in shadow, and the upper levels were entirely unlit. Climbing to the first balcony brought them into the pitch dark, which Rachel welcomed, because when the cop unhooked a pocket torch from his belt, he dropped her hand. As she asked him to, he shone the cone of light into the face of every old man they passed, until, in a corner on the second balcony, they came upon him. He was a semi-conscious hulk, like dozens of others, collapsed upon himself. Yet she knew him at once. "Papa, Papa," she said, dropping the suitcase to kneel beside him, enclosing her father in her embrace. The policeman leaned to her and whispered, "Do not let them see that he is sick." "He is not sick," Rachel hissed in reply. "He is only tired." She pulled her father up, clutched his face, and drew it close to her own. "Papa, do you see it's me?" His eyes were open but swimming, and when she saw that he could not hold his head erect, she let him down again. To the policeman she said, "Shine a light here," as she opened the suitcase. He did so. She withdrew the brick of chocolate and efficiently proceeded to unwrap it, exposing the knife. She unfolded its blade and shaved slivers of the chocolate into her hand, perhaps 50 grams worth. Then, propping her father up, she fed the bits into his mouth. He was conscious enough to cooperate and took the pieces in hungrily. When he'd eaten the chocolate, she took one of the bananas, peeled it back, and placed several of its slices into his mouth as well. He swallowed with difficulty, but he took what she fed him. Then again, he leaned against her. She reached into the suitcase for his yarmulke. She placed it on his head. "He should not wear that," the cop said. Rachel said, "You think they don't know he's a Jew?" The bitterness in her eyes made the Flick withdraw, leaving Rachel and her father alone in the dark corner. Nearby, there was a mother nursing an infant and a trio of boys squabbling. Old women had arranged themselves in circles of quiet lamentation and, closest at hand, a clutch of men were davening at a candle. Someone was sobbing. Within perhaps half an hour of eating, Saul was able to sit up. He squeezed Rachel's hand, then released it, which was their signal that he was well. She turned back to the suitcase and withdrew the Nachmanides commentary on Job. He received it gratefully, pressing it to his breast. She handed him his glasses, which